The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
You're listening to the PVD Cast with John Orlando.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 532. I hope all is well with you out there, and thank you very much for checking out this edition of the PVD Cast. So today's topic is going to be one that is going to be a lot of fun to discuss. It's going to be a walk down memory lane, so to speak. My good friend, the man behind the pop culture cosmos, Gerald Glassford, is going to join me as we have a discussion about the territories. Now, originally, we had thought about doing a lot of different territories, but as soon as we started recording, we saw that we were going to have to cut this kind of a little bit short. So that's why this is part number one of what's going to be, I'm sure, a multi-episode series, so to speak. We're going to be covering world-class wrestling, we're going to be covering ECW, we're going to talk about Memphis wrestling or CWA or Mid-Southern, whatever you want to call it. And of course, we'll talk a little bit about Vern Gagne's AWA as well. We're going to talk all about those promotions, giving you some of the opinions that we had as fans watching as we were younger. We'll also talk about maybe what could have been done to save that territory from demise. And maybe even talk about some favorite feuds and some favorite superstars that came from that territory. So it's going to be a great episode, especially if you're a wrestling fanatic like Gerald and I happen to be. But before we get to my conversation with Gerald, I would like to thank a quick sponsor of the PVD Cast, that being, of course, Courtney 614 Deals. If you need great deals on a plethora of different items, such as women's fashion, health and beauty, glassware, then you look no further than Courtney 614. You can find her at all those major reselling sites like Whatnot, eBay, Facebook Marketplace, Poshmark, etc., etc. Simply look for Courtney, C-O-R-T-N-E-Y, 614 Deals. And if you happen to pick up anything, please let her know that you heard about the shop from right here on the PVD Cast. With that, I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of the break, you're going to hear my conversation with Gerald Glassford as we talk about territories.
Ding, 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 and we're back with another episode of The State of Pro Wrestling. It's Gerald Glassford coming right back at you here from the Pop Culture Cosmos. Thank you so much for joining us. And also, as well, don't forget to go ahead and make sure you like and subscribe. That 5-star review really helps us out right here at the State of Pro Wrestling, whether it's the PVD Cast, 5-star there, Matt Talk, 5-star there, Pop Culture Cosmos, 5-star here, or Lakers Fast Break, or whatever we're doing right now or later. Please go ahead and support us with a like, subscribe, whatever you can do to support us right here from the great channels that we do outside of the State of Pro Wrestling as well. But it wouldn't be a State of Pro Wrestling and this special brought to you from the State of Pro Wrestling without a good man indeed, my tag team partner, who is out of the Matt Talk and also PVD Cast world himself. He comes in at a combined weight with me of, I don't know,
475.
Okay, I was going to go 30 pounds, very light, but 475 sounds good. 475 sounds like a Pro Wrestling Illustrated list right there. That we're like, it's so weird how they did those things. I'm looking at ranking the an old screenshot of some rankings the other day, and I'm like, okay, why do the number 3 contenders for the WCW Tag Team Championships. Why are they number two overall in the world? And I'm just trying to think to myself, you know, that math really doesn't add up, but I get it. It's star based. It was the aftermags. It's the whole nine yards. It's my good friend. It is John Orlando. And I've got a story to tell you here. John, great to have you here, my friend.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it, Gerald. Again, we're doing another special edition of the State of Pro Wrestling. It's going to be a fun one. It's going to be a good one. And I think you who are watching or listening to this, you're in for a great episode.
Before we go into it, I did want to mention Pro Wrestling Illustrated at the non-After Mag version, because Bill After left PWI and now is doing his own thing. It's ironic, though, that PWI is still alive in some format and actually tries to do podcasts. But did you know that their most recent podcast that they do, about as far as it's concerned, has less viewership than our last monthly installment of the State of Pro Wrestling?
No, I did not know that, but that's a tip of the hat to us, I would say.
Absolutely. Well, you throw Danhausen on the cover and look what happens, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Brings the people right there for you. But, you know, there you go. Hey, we talk Danhausen here on this show, that's for sure. But this special episode is going to be based on our memories and of the territories and independent scene as a whole as we grew up in the 80s and the 90s. I know we titled and I prefaced it as territory memories, but there's also going to be a lot of independent wrestling involved in this as well. So basically, when we concern ourselves with the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, there were a lot of pro wrestling companies out there that were either through agreements or just by the sheer nature of where they were popular at, were based in certain areas and did not really expand outside the areas. In most cases, there were some, the UWF, AWA, World Class, but there's a lot of smaller territories that just stayed within its confines of its own space. So be that as it may, we thought we would go ahead and touch with you guys as far as our memories, what worked and what didn't work with these organizations, as many of them got swallowed up by the machine known in the 80s as the WWF, and how they succeeded and how they failed ultimately in doing so. So, John, you are the first on the list with your pick as far as territory, or again, independent wrestling memories. Territory memories just had like a little bit better click to it. So your thoughts on your first organization that you have memories with, and I will listen along and chime in, you know, if you need me to do so.
Well, let me ask the question here real quick. Are we going to go with the territory and then memorable feuds, superstars, and
what made it so special? What made it so special? Yeah, you don't have to point out specifics, although sometimes that does help. But you know, obviously, a generalization would probably suffice better.
Well, I'm going to go with my favorite promotion, World Class Championship Wrestling.
I'm going to do that in the background.
That theme is very, very, very catchy, if I may say so.
There was a time in the year that they changed that theme song like three different times, like 87 or 88. Yep. I was watching it like earlier this year from that. There's a year where they're just like, I think it's 88, where they just don't have everything from that year as far as all the shows available on YouTube. But you can see throughout the year, they decide, okay, well, that theme song isn't working. Let's do this one. Well, that didn't work. Let's do this one.
And then also they changed the whole background. It wasn't even wrestling involved, was it? It was like the skyline of Dallas, and it's like, who cares? Yes. You know. Anyways, you know, one thing I think that many people don't realize is that World Class Championship Wrestling actually was run by a promoter who called it Big Time Wrestling, Ed McLemore, and Fritz was his kind of partner, and eventually throughout the years, somewhere around the late 70s. Macklemore, if I remember correctly, had a heart attack and passed away. And then Fritz took over, and there we go with the rise of the kingdom of the Von Erichs, with the David, Kerry, and Kevin coming on board and starting their careers. You know, 82 to 86 was probably their best 4 years that they had, because they just had the feuds, they had the booking, they had the good undercard. You know, when you look at the biggest feud that come out of World Class Championship Wrestling, not WCW, but WCCW, would be the Fabulous Freebirds against the Von Erichs. I think just the way that Gary Hart can conceive that idea and put those plans into action as the booker, one of the greatest feuds of all time. I mean, the Freebirds versus the Von Erichs. The only bad part about that is it works so well that many times, if World Class had nothing else, let's just do the Freebirds versus the Von Erichs again. And I think at that point, because you didn't have David, because you didn't have Mike, Chris was not quite the physical specimen, despite the fact of having the gumption to want to be a wrestler, the product suffered, you know, because you can only ride that horse so much, and then eventually you got to either get off that horse or figure something else out. And I honestly feel like that's one of the things that really hindered and damaged World Class, was not building up other great wrestlers that could be plugged in. Not saying that they're better than the Von Erichs, but somebody to support the Von Erichs. You know, I mean, besides Chris Adams, I don't know of any other baby faces that they had that was real super strong.
Well, again, and even he had a memorable feud with Von Erichs along with Gino Hernandez. But I also think that tragedy and mismanagement, you're going to see mismanagement at the theme of why virtually all of these companies failed. Mm-hmm. As far as that's concerned, mismanagement is just it's a big key into this. But with World Class in those 82 to 86 era, especially 82, 83, like you said, there was probably no bigger feud on the planet than what was going on with in Texas with the Von Erichs versus the Freebirds, and how well that was getting over in Dallas at the Sportatorium on a weekly basis, and how well it thrilled audiences. But like you said, just the fact that they couldn't sustain it, and then the Von Erichs themselves suffering tragedy with David's issue in dying in Japan, then Mike. But Mike really never was that much of an acclaimed wrestler. Let's just be honest here. And his career was cut, even shorter with a tragic shoulder injury in Israel. Suffered there, which led to a botched surgery, toxic shock syndrome. He was never really the same, and committed suicide shortly thereafter. And then, of course, we've seen with Kerry Von Erich, who eventually did the same thing in the 90s as far as taking his own life. It's just a series of tragedies with them. Gino Hernandez cocaine overdose or mm-hmm. an overdose of some type, also passing away right in the middle of a big feud with him and Chris Adams, just ending with Chris Adams and Gino Hernandez against the Von Erichs, and then switching into a Chris Adams versus Gino Hernandez feud. It's just, I could understand why they lost a lot. They had a lot and a great talent. They had the Ultimate Warrior when he was the Dingo Warrior. They had One Man Gang, Rick Rude. They had a plethora of great talent that came across. The Undertaker, Steve Austin, started their careers there at that time. Later, those two later, technically, you could say they came under the USWA banner as far as the concern, which we'll go into here a little bit later on as far as that end of it. But the Texas area, the World Class Sportatorium era, that, again, when you talk about the World Class era, it it's so compelling storytelling at its height in between 82, like 82 and 86, and you said, and then it just falls off a cliff because it could no longer sustain the talent base. It can no longer sustain what storylines you could keep it going. And plus the reliance on the Von Erichs to keep it open. And as they went through their troubles, Kerry Von Erich's motorcycle accident, and amputation of one of his feet, Kevin Von Erich had his own issues as well during that time. Just again, they relied so heavily on feeding heels to the Von Erichs that they just did not continue to try and develop other stars of their own, like you said, that could either outpace or outdo the Von Erichs, or, you know, just replace the Von Erichs in some fashion. It was because it was run by, mainly in those years, Fritz Von Erich, the father. He was intentionally just feeding everything through the Von Erichs, and that's what I think ultimately led to its demise, is because of the fact that, you know, you could not sustain any really good outside characters or outside wrestlers, because of the fact that they just didn't want to end up being on the other side of the fence to the Von Erichs, you know, ultimately on every single battle.
Well, I have two other things real quick to mention, because I know we talked off air about what really made us like these promotions. And I will tell you that for me, World Class was chaotic. Like, there was chaos in some of those matches, especially if you had Bruiser Brody and Abdullah the Butcher, or Brody and Abdullah against anyone. That was going to be chaos. That was going to be mayhem. And for me,
that's my favorite feud of all time, by the
yeah.
way.
Yeah. And for me, I love Brody. I love Bruiser Brody. He was the star that came out of World Class that shone brightest for me, because again, I believe that he was this crazed lunatic madman from New Mexico. And, you know, on TV, I was looking at the WWF that was giving us Jim Evans versus the Ultimate Warrior, who I didn't care about, but I would care about, you know, the Von Erichs versus the Super Destroyers. That was a main event match that was on free television, you know, and I was hooked as a kid. So I think for me, yeah, definitely the chaos, the mayhem is what drew me into it, because the WWF was so predictable to an extent.
It was so hard, though, to keep up with title changes, because they didn't always air title changes, whether they happened at another arenas like the Will Rogers Coliseum or something like that on the main show, because they didn't ever fully recognize their audience. They were one of the first to syndicate their show out to not only just, you know, Israel, but the entire country. I saw World Class on a weekly basis on California television, but they just never realized, I think, entirety their audience, so that they never kept anything cohesive. Like, you would see people that come in, they've lost their titles and you didn't know how, won titles, didn't know how. And then again, like I said, as after 86, they really started a talent drop off. They were not bringing in the crowds. So not bringing the crowds means they're not able to pay the wrestlers. And guess what? The wrestlers started to really trend towards going to either Crockett or WWF, which is a recurring theme that you'll probably hear throughout. And in doing so, you know, it's just the product became less enjoyable to watch, because you realize that these were individuals that are just not quite as appealing or as good enough as what you're used to seeing.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned the WWF and Crockett, but don't forget about UWF, because Bill Watts was cherry picking a lot of talent from World Class and bringing them over.
Well, I mean, he worked talent trades in the beginning when it was Mid-South with World Class. But when it became UWF was a short lived venture in reality, as far as what, two and a half years before it got purchased by World Championship Wrestling. So with that's the case, yes, they did have an alternate, because it was Oklahoma versus Texas. I mean, if you finished up in Texas, you would just go to Oklahoma and vice versa. I mean, Chris Adams hopped back and forth as far as between the UWF and WCCW. So yeah, like you said, there was talent migrating there. as well when the UWF started to make its push towards a national national company. But again, WCCW just started to lose its allure, and ultimately USWA, which we'll talk about later on, came in, bought it out, and they, you know, the last gleaming hope was the Eric Embry angle, which we'll talk about more in USWA as I feed that into what went on in Memphis as well.
All right, well, let's hear one of your favorite territories.
Well, then let's go into USWA since that happened. As far as the death of WCCW, which actually happened on screen, because as like was mentioned, in the dying days of World Class, the USWA, which he had evolved out of Mid-Southern wrestling out of Tennessee, headed up for many years by one Jerry Lawler, as far as concerned, the king of Memphis per se, and this was Tennessee based wrestling as far as it's, and they were just for the most part very intent on keeping it within the confines of the Memphis area and thereabouts. Their television ratings for a local market were huge at one time, at the height in its 80s. It still lasted in some semblance as far as USWA into the 90s and even I think in the brief period of probably early 2000s, but ultimately it lost its allure as a marketplace in the early 90s after the fallout of the USWA WCCW purchase, because like you talked about with Fritz von Erich, he had sold off his shares to the Jarretts with that owned USWA, and in doing so the USWA had one last gasp with Eric Embry, of all people, of all the individuals to fight for the entire wrestling organization. I don't think you had at that point in time Eric Embry on the books as doing so. If you saw how he looked and what he was perceived as, a mid-card guy, nothing special, certainly not a you know, he had a physique from the 70s, let's just put it kindly, as far as it's concerned. On a major scale, he would have been nothing more than a jobber, but as a guy who could talk a little and a guy who could work a little, he was able to go ahead and build up something, at least one last gasp for World Class as a transition to the USWA. The USWA closed out the World Class, organization and changed it into USWA. And they tried for a while to go ahead and make it a Tennessee, Texas type agreement as far as it's concerned, and working, you know, the guys working in Memphis and working in the area and then going to Texas and going back and forth. But it just, the Texas, you know, if we ever go ahead and touch on the global area, it's just so hard to go ahead once you lose that crowd to get them back. And they never, after that final World Class run into USWA and that final match with Eric Embry and the late Phil Hickerson, mm-hmm. Who recently passed away, our condolences. It never was the same, but USWA at its height, in the Memphis area, they captivated the Memphis audience. I know that between the brief run the run for Jerry Lawler, for as AWA World Heavyweight Champion based out of Memphis, and what he was doing there, turned into the USWA World title run, which for him meant like 30 to 40, 50 title changes. You know, he believed in title changes almost every single time out, every single weekend, back and forth, with him and many other stars, some unknown, some known, things of that nature. But for decades, the USWA Mid-South, let's just say Mid-South, that version of Mid-South or Mid-Southern wrestling, was a cornerstone of the territory industry. Basic setup, a key wrestling show based out of a television studio and telling the story, telling the narration where you're doing all your angles, where you're doing all your stuff, then try to go out on the road to surrounding towns and cities in and around the Memphis area and not taking you too far away from it. And once they got and tried to get bigger with the USWA expansion, they felt their death knell to an extent as well. Now, again, they survived in a smaller fashion, and we still see the remnants of that today in Memphis Wrestling, the small independent organization that's there. But still, there could have been a little bit more as far as they're concerned. But they had their talent. The Blade Runners came through, and as far as the most of Master Pain, aka The Undertaker, also came through there. Sid Vicious came through there as you know, big names that came through there. Many big names, Scott Hall went through there as well. You know, there's so many big names that came through both world-class and Mid-South wrestling, or Mid-Southern wrestling, I'll just say, that, again, it's a shame that they were not able to keep up. When you're a locally based wrestling organization, if they didn't have those Monday shows at the Mid-South Coliseum that in the 80s were drawing so well, and in fact, so well, remember the hair versus title match with Austin Idol versus Jerry Lawler in a cage. The first time Paul E. Dangerously, aka Paul Heyman, ever became really prominent in the world of wrestling, that led to Tommy Rich coming under the ring, sabotaging the match, and Jerry Lawler having his head cut, going bald and whatnot, and them cutting his hair and things of that nature. So with that said, my friend, what are your thoughts on Mid-South wrestling and Memphis, Tennessee?
Well, I think Memphis was again, for a kid that was growing up, I didn't get to see a lot of Memphis. I didn't have access to it. What little bit I did see seemed to be, again, chaotic, unscripted. I think that's something that you're going to hear me say at least one more time today. But yeah, I think that was it. I think that, you know, you got to look at the fact that for how many years, the ratings that Memphis wrestling would pull in the general metro area and the rest of Tennessee, especially Western Tennessee. I mean, there are TV shows nowadays, or even back then, that didn't get the ratings that Memphis got on a Saturday morning. You know, from, I think they were on at 11 to 12:30, it bested some other national television products. And so I think that's something that you got to look at it. You know, I think that, you know, Jerry Lawler did the right thing, you know, kind of buddying up with Vince McMahon when he went to go be the commentator, and then allowing Vince to kind of use Memphis as a NXT before there was an NXT, so to speak, you know. But I mean, I enjoyed Memphis. I could continue to sit here and talk about all the different things that I saw, like the Tupelo concession stand, brawl, the empty arena to this day is one of my favorite matches. Terry Funk and Jerry Lawler, the empty arena match.
My eye.
My favorite is when he looks at Lawler and goes, "You got a knife? You got a gun, Lawler?" Like, I love that. That makes me laugh still to this day.
And Memphis was such a hotbed for wrestling for decades, like in the 60s and 70s with Jackie Fargo and, mm-hmm. and again, so many great names. Like I mentioned earlier, Bill Dundee, Jerry Lawler, of course, from the early 70s, becoming the biggest name in all of Memphis wrestling. If you were to ask me what is a territory wrestling, I would probably have to give you Memphis wrestling as the mm-hmm. quintessential definition of what territory wrestling should be.
Yeah. I'd say a close second is Crockett.
There you go. Florida, you could include that as far as territory wrestling at its height. But again, they too fell under the auspices of what happened with the WWF. In fact, Jerry Lawler, as you know, became a commentator / wrestler on the WWF scene because he saw the writing on the wall. And again, it looks like, you know, what happened was that, you know, the WWF there as well. Once they took a big, good bit of talent away from that area as well, it just, you know, it's hard to fight against such a powerful machine that was growing at that time in the mid to late 80s and early 90s that we saw with the WWF / WWE.
Agreed 100%.
So any final memories of Memphis wrestling? Because again, I still, you know, at one time they were getting astronomical ratings for the city of Memphis. They were providing Jim Cornette, Jimmy Hart, you know, they got their managerial starts in Memphis. The Andy Kaufman feud that gained national prominence before what happened or right around the time of Hulkamania. That gained national prominence, you know, you could argue even before Hulkamania did. So any last thoughts, my friend, on Memphis before we head to the break?
No, I would say I'll just give a cheap plug. Memphis Heat is a great documentary that if you are ignorant or want to learn more about Memphis territory, I say seek that out. I really enjoyed it. I liked it so much, I actually bought a physical copy of it. So yeah, that's how much I liked it. So yeah, so check that out. But yeah, I mean, what can you say about Memphis? Like I said, I didn't get a lot of it. I got a little bit here and there. But from what I saw as a kid, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, there you go. Indeed, it is Memphis wrestling. So go ahead and make sure you dive into it. I mean, if you just type it up out there, just type in Jerry Lawler, Memphis wrestling. And there are, thankfully, with Eddie Gilbert, we didn't even mention Eddie Gilbert and the battles that he had with him, getting run over. Eddie Gilbert running over Jerry Lawler right outside the studio. It was you know, staged. You know, he did a stuntman style deal, of course, but still, as an angle, it provided stuff. The fireball was very present and popular during the days of Memphis wrestling. So, yeah, absolutely, just so many great memories.
And we can't forget about the voice of Memphis wrestling, Lance Russell. That's iconic. His voice
and
is
Dave
iconic.
Brown, yes, iconic indeed. I mean, if you want to check out our list of announcers, yeah, still gets looked at on a almost daily basis. So check it out on the popculturecosmos.wordpress.com site, indeed, my friend. But great to go ahead and you know, just travel down the road of these territories. And I cannot thank you enough, my friend, for doing so, indeed.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's a blast. And I can't wait to talk more.
You're listening to the Pop Culture Cosmos.
Ding, ding, ding. And we're back for the second half of our show in regards to the memories that we have, territory memories, independent wrestling organization memories, the days of wrestling organizations gone by, whether they were a territory, whether they were actual full-fledged national operation. It's our look, our nostalgic look at what made them so special, what worked, and ultimately what didn't. We covered in the first half hour two of our favorites in world-class championship wrestling, and then also Mid-Southern, Mid-South, just say Memphis wrestling, and I think you're good there with that. So if you guys and gals want to check out as far as everything, and if you're younger and you're not and you don't know where to look, just go to YouTube. Just type in Memphis wrestling or world-class championship wrestling, Von Erichs, Freebirds, and it all comes right up for you. My friend, John Orlando from the PVD cast and Matt Talk, where do we go next?
We're going to talk about my second favorite wrestling area, territory, promotion, whatever you want to call it, and that is Extreme Championship Wrestling. I was a huge ECW fan, and I think that I first was exposed to it due to the After Mags. But then we got this syndicated show. I think it was on at like two or three in the morning on the local channel. So I was videotaping a lot of that. And again, the same way that I really loved World Class was because ECW was kind of like World Class in that it was chaotic. It was full of madness and mayhem. And, you know, let's be honest, Gerald, that 1993, 1994, 1995, it was not a stellar years for the WWF at the time or WCW at the time, and a lot of bad booking, a lot of hokey gimmicks, a lot of really bad ideas. And I just started watching and heard about ECW, and there was guys putting guys through tables, which I had never heard of before. And there were all these great matches that were technical sensations. And I just became addicted. I became a mark for ECW. I would go see them anytime they were in the area next to my hometown. I was going to go see them, no matter if I drove 50 miles, 100 miles. It didn't matter. I was that captivated by ECW. And you know what? I'm not going to say that it was flawless. It was perfect. Because, Gerald, as you probably have done so as well, sometimes when you go back and watch some of these matches that you remember being so awesome, you find out they're not so awesome. You know what I mean?
Well, they had some good moments. Those triple threat matches, Sabu versus RVD. The match with Sabu and RVD as a tag team when they had their run as tag team champions. Jinsei Shinsaki, and I think they had more Japanese wrestlers go that they brought in. You know that they were really into the of course, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, those wrestlers, Dean Malenko, as far as that type of wrestling, they appreciated it. Cactus Jack, a.k.a. Mick Foley, made an extended appearance in one of the... I guess more memorable moments as far as more memorable characters that appeared. Steve Austin did a cup of coffee there as well, mainly though as a on-air voice as he was recovering from injury after he was let go by World Championship Wrestling. So it did a lot to define hardcore wrestling and wrestling in general that we still see remnants of today, especially in AEW. I think it is no... guess doubt about it as far as how clear-cut it is as far as how much of a fan Tony Khan was at ECW, because the influence is clearly there in what we see today as far as the hardcore wrestling element in AEW, but even to an extent to WWE showcases that as well. But of course, Paul Heyman today is still the benefactor. He's somehow, despite all the money troubles, despite the expansion that went awry, despite the fact that the words spending beyond your means seemed to be the running thing of the day, and the fact he might have never paid entirely all the wrestlers everything that they deserved, somehow he still managed to find his way on top after all the dust was settled. And even though he had to sell up his company, Paul Heyman is still a thing to this day.
Well, you know, one of the things I think that, you know, when you were talking there that clicked in my head was this was the first influx of Lucha Libre that we saw, really. It wasn't that much, you know, prior to it, but, you know, you're getting Rey Mysterio, Psicosis, Juventud Guerrera, Conan. You're getting those folks coming up from Mexico, and they're being showcased on ECW TV, and no doubt that's what definitely led for a lot of those guys to end up on the radar of WCW.
Absolutely. And again, ECW will always leave its influence on wrestling for years and decades to come. So I'm very grateful for my time watching ECW. Did it go too far at points? I think it did. It went too far at points with what they were trying to go ahead and do. Some controversial angles were too much. The mass transit angle was obviously something that is regrettable to this day. The crucifixion angle was also something that went a little bit beyond, what even went beyond extreme, to say the least. But the fact that you're pushing the envelope is something that Paul Heyman constantly wanted to do, and why ECW was such a can't miss television show every time it came on the air.
And ECW allowed people to show their personalities. And to me, this is one of the great positives of ECW. I would watch an episode of the TV show and they would introduce a new character and I would go, gosh, that guy's awful. I can name, like, a prime example is Steve Corino. When he first showed up, I didn't get the character. I didn't care about the guy, but the way that Heyman and Steve Corino worked their character within a month, I'm like, oh yeah, Steve Corino's awesome. Again, that shows the talent that both Heyman had and the trust that Heyman had with his talents to do what they needed to do or what they felt their characters would do. I can name a ton of the Baldies was another one that within the first couple weeks, I was like, this stinks. This is awful. What? But man, by about another couple weeks, I was heads and tails hooked with the Baldies as a group, as a tag team. So again, I think it's been said many times, Heyman was great at hiding the weaknesses and promoting the strengths of his talent.
Yes, and also getting that talent to believe in itself. He was a master manipulator behind the scenes as well as in front of it. No one could say he wasn't one of the best ever at doing that as far as being able to manipulate the crowd, manipulate the performers into doing what he wanted them to do or going into a direction he wanted them to go in. No one can say otherwise than that. And again, at one time, it was the behind, of course, WWE, WWF, and then World Championship Wrestling. It was the number three company in America. And, you know, it wasn't actually as at the level, I would say, as a All Japan or a New Japan in the late 90s, 2000s. But as the third company in America, they tried to go ahead and branch themselves out and started to extend themselves out into a wider and wider area. And stop me if you ever heard this before on this episode. That's partly, you know, that's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons of what did ECW in.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. Those pay-per-views from Los Angeles. I know you're a native. I know you are fond of the City of Angels, but those should not have been happening at that time. When you're having money issues, you need to stay. They should have stayed in that Philadelphia, New York, Boston kind of area while they were redoing their budgets or figuring out to get cash flow or whatever, doing more events, even out here in the Midwest, you know, in Milwaukee and Chicago and, you know, even Ohio. That maybe wasn't the best move, you know?
No, but, you know, obviously you and I have such fond memories of ECW because even to this day, you'll still on rare occasions when a table's broken or when an extreme measure is taken or basically a very suicidal like move is made in the ring or coming out of the ring that reminds you of what RVD, Sabu, and many others did at that point in time. You might hear the chant ECW, ECW, ECW. Mm-hmm. Well, again, ECW Extreme Championship Wrestling emanating in the early days from Eastern Championship Wrestling and evolving into Extreme Championship Wrestling, again, left its mark and imprint on the professional wrestling industry. You cannot say otherwise. Ultimately, though, it did succumb to the higher expenses. It's a TNN contract when it wanted to go nationwide just wasn't enough and wasn't what, you know, they were able to go ahead and do. Is there a tarnished legacy? Because when they sold out to the WWE, WWE, in its infinite wisdom, decided to go ahead and try to recreate the ECW brand, but almost homogenize it in a way, like have just like a neutered version of it that was more palatable to a WWE audience in their own mind, but ended up making ECW pretty much worthless at that point in time. Do you think it hurt the legacy ultimately of what ECW did by doing that?
No, I don't think so, because you know, you got the one night stand, those two events, and then they get the bright idea to relaunch it as a third brand. I think most wrestling fans, most ECW fans realize that relaunch and the show being on, wasn't on Sci-Fi, I think it was the ECW version of WWE or the WWE version of ECW, I think was on that, I believe. But I think fans knew this is a shell of its former self, and this is not exactly what we grew up liking, what we watched diligently. I don't think the image is tarnished at all.
And as we saw, as we talked about this before I brought you back on, I got a chance, my Facebook algorithm brought up an old show from ECW Hardcore Television. One of my favorite groupings was Tajiri and Super Crazy. And some of my all-time favorite matches were Masato Tanaka versus Mike Awesome. I really thought, okay, you could get those two in a closet to do a match, and it would still be a 3.5-4-star match, in my opinion, because they just, you just find those combinations that work with each other. And like I said, Sabu and RVD, whether it was against each other or not against each other, they had sensational matches. Sandman and Tommy Dreamer with Raven and Raven's Flock, they had great matches and great chemistry together and even better storytelling for the most part on that. And when it comes right down to match, Shane Douglas, obviously, he excelled as, you know, quite often the ECW champion from time to time, but as the franchise, he excelled with that organization. And just Taz, the rise of Taz, mm-hmm. as being able to, the suplex master indeed, and the guy was able to put a lot of holds, 1,000 holds on you per se, with his amazing skill and technique and submission and suplex-based wrestling. Just a different look and different style, different feel. Like you said, the luchadors, the Japanese stars, the influence of the hardcore audience was felt each and every time out. And again, there's so many great memories I have of ECW as well.
Yep, same here. I agree with you on all of those fronts. I mean, and just think, if there was no ECW, we wouldn't have Lance Storm. We wouldn't have Tommy Dreamer. We wouldn't have Taz, because they would have been doing their original gimmicks probably, you know, which some of them hokey, some of them cool. It just depended. But yeah, I mean, the legacy of ECW, unfortunately, many people will say it's the hardcore brawling, but I think that's just one part of the, I liken it to baking a cake. You have different ingredients that you have to include. In that hardcore match, you needed to include. But then that high-flying Two Cold Scorpio match, you needed. You needed a tag team comedy with the Dudleys, you know. You needed all that stuff. And hopefully, if all those ingredients merged well together, if you will, you had a great show. And I got to say, there weren't too many ECW shows that I came out going, man, that was a waste of my time and money.
Well, that is Extreme Championship Wrestling. Absolutely a great part of the history of professional wrestling. And again, a company who, through Paul Heyman, was able to go ahead and influence this industry then and for years to come indeed. But before we head on out, I think we're only going to hit 4 total. We had like 8 already lined up as far as organizations, but I think we're going to only have to hit up 4. I did want to go ahead, and I'm not going to go ahead and use them today. I'll go in more detail. Maybe I'll wear this next time out when we do this and catch up. But I wanted to give everybody an idea. NWC, that was based out of here in Vegas in the 90s. I still have a shirt from them. I'm going to go ahead and hit that up another day and save that for another day as far as it's concerned, because that leads into a lot of ECW inference and things of that nature as far as the highs and lows of an independent company. But you had something. Yes, John.
Well, I was going to say, I just learned about NWC. I don't want to get in. I'll save it for when we talk about it. But I didn't even know it existed until, I want to say, maybe a year ago or 2 years ago. I caught some of their stuff on YouTube. Yeah, I had no idea. So I'm excited to talk about NWC, but we could do that at another time, in another edition or another episode.
Because the reason why I wanted to bring up with that as far as ECW, Mid-Southern, because I think Mid-Southern with Memphis Wrestling just throughout the years had such a great history. You talked about World Class having such a great history as well. I think we've got to owe a lot of debt to what we went through and experienced as fans with the boom of wrestling in the WWF in the mid-1980s and late 1980s to one company. You could obviously do it to, you know, pay respects to WCW, aka, as far as the Crockett territory, for providing a lot of wrestlers, which they did. You could say Florida for providing some wrestlers, which they did. World Class, which they did. And others, which they did. But the one company I think that was hurt the most by the WWF expansion was none other than Vern Gagne's American Wrestling Association, the AWA. I think they were hurt more than any particular company because they were, at one time, late 70s through the early to, I'd say 84, 85, they were a nationally, and they tried to as well continue as after that, but before they died, a, not I will say thriving, but a very comfortable national or ish wrestling chain. Now they, as far as an organization is concerned, they traveled from the Midwest. Minneapolis was their base, but they also traveled as far west as Las Vegas, San Francisco, Denver were various hotspots for them in their heyday. And then they proceeded as far east sometimes as going into New Jersey. But they kept, you know, the balance as far as not going and intruding in places where they weren't supposed to go because of the territory markings and whatnot. They were in Chicago, did a lot of stuff there as well. But I think they were hurt more than any company by Vince's expansion with Hulkamania and whatnot. First off, because they got Hulk. Hulk Hogan is the number one reason why. But that's their own doing. Vern Gagne would not let Hogan win the title. When he did win against perennial champion Nick Bockwinkel, that would always be through a dusty finish, aka a disqualification finish, or a finish where it looks like he won, but it was actually got turned into a different decision as far as it's concerned. Getting Hulk Hogan or away from the AWA was a, it did twofold. Obviously, it catapulted WWF into a new realm, coming off the success of Rocky III as Thunderlips. And then also as well, it permanently damaged the WWF that they could, excuse me, the AWA, permanently damaged the AWA so that they were already starting to really feel the hit after Hulk Hogan left.
Hulk Hogan's the first piece of the puzzle. And then who else did Vince go after? Bobby Heenan, Mean Gene Okerlund, Jesse the Body Ventura. The list goes on and on and on. And supposedly, I've always heard the story that Vince wanted just to buy out the AWA. And when Vern kind of got disrespectful in that conversation with Vince, that Vince made it very personal that he was going to run Vern Gagne out of business, that there was not going to be a buyout. And that's
the, and the problem was, though, and yeah, that's I believe that is that could be a very much truth in it, because the AWA, it had an advantage, John. It was in the early days of ESPN, it was on every afternoon. It had a prime slot right as soon as I came home from school around 3 p.m., which would be about 6 p.m. Eastern time. It was there and available for an audience around the country, and still that was during the mid 80s, and it had a presence. It had a, I mean, there's a famous picture around 83, I think 83 with a whole lineup. I know you've probably seen it probably on Facebook or wherever that they showed about the actual whole roster taking a picture with Vern Gagne, with having from everywhere from Andre the Giant to Hulk Hogan to, you know, they had the Road Warriors. They had the Road Warriors at one time, as well, the Freebirds at one time. They had many stars go through their higher echelon stars. But one thing was always the same, despite the fact that they had a national TV deal, despite the fact that they had alliances to do promotional events like Pro Wrestling USA, Later on, the ill-advised Super Clash 3 with other companies involved, indeed. That's something we might want to go into at some point in time, and that disaster. Is Vern Gagne and how he presented the product. Vern Gagne wanted something based on what he had in the 60s and 70s, which was more of a sports, athletic, wrestling, in-the-ring product. Less showboating, less pomp, less circumstance, less interviews, less storytelling inside and outside the ring. He wanted everything based on a more like what we would see in a UFC fight. Just two combatants go in it and go at it and go from there. Just a little bit of interviews and stuff surrounding it before you actually get to the match. And long-term storytelling was something that he just didn't do very well. And the fact that the product itself on its television deal always looked dated was never a helpful thing. And I mean, you would, on the weekends, you would go and you would take a look at and see the syndicated shows, Wrestling Superstars and Wrestling Challenge, and you see how well they were produced and how slickly they looked. And then you would look throughout the week and you'd see this AWA graphic that was made back in, looked like the early 80s. And it just, it looked like, again, with World Champ Class Championship Wrestling, it had a dated look and presentation that it did not age well, comparatively speaking, to what we saw with WWF. And as the money kept flowing and the bodies kept leaving, just like World Class, they just did not replace them with quality individuals. And the presentation, the lack of storytelling, the lack of characters, they dried up even faster. I would argue they would dried up even faster than World Class Championship Wrestling. They were hurt substantially in the mid 80s. And by 87, they were just about toast.
And, you know, you have to factor in that Vern was using, you know, his stuff that he had at Lake Minnetonka, that he was kind of, in other words, using money and profits from that to fund the AWA. And when that whole, when the state decided to try to take over part of that land, and then Vern sued them and that took up money, you're looking at just a snowball effect, you know?
But losing Hogan was that caused the downfall and ultimately the death of the AWA.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you 100%, because if he still had Hogan, he would be making money at the ticket booth, and he could still probably maybe, you know, do whatever legal ramifications he needed to do to save his project or save his property, excuse me. But yeah, I mean, you look at who was on that roster in the AWA, and it's like a who's who of pro wrestling. And when they started leaving, they weren't ever replaced. I mean, because in 87, you have the Midnight Rockers coming in, you have Scott Hall coming in, you have a Leon White, aka Vader, coming in, you have Hansen there part-time. So they were filling the slots a little bit, but when you look at all those guys, a lot of those guys were really young and they didn't know what they were doing. And maybe the match qualities weren't as good as they could have been. And I know that's another big thing that people like to rag on the AWA about, was that they were the stereotypical superstar versus jobber or enhancement talent or whatever. And that was the entire show. And a lot of times, boring. Nobody wanted to see that. And Vern doesn't roll with the punches. Vern didn't understand.
Well, the thing is, though, I want to put on this point, and I'll argue before we head it out, and that is, okay, you can have squash matches throughout your show if you're telling a story,
right?
Along with those, like, because again, I've talked about the presentation of WWF that they had at that time on their syndicated shows, and they were telling a story with each squash match, as far as the characters and their feuding, who they're feuding with, or whatever story they're trying to tell. With the AWA, it was just they're calling the match and that's it. And like you said, that can become repetitive and boring.
Yeah. So, you know, it stinks that the AWA ended up fizzling out the way it did. I mean, its legacy, I think, in the industry is definitely going to be that if it wasn't for the AWA, the WWF wouldn't have half the roster that it did when the expansion begins. And, you know, that's all I can say. I mean, I will say this just real quickly, because I know we've been also highlighting some of the feuds, important feuds that we've seen. I was really shocked when I found out, and this was probably 5 years ago or something, when I found out that one of my favorite matches of all time, that 1 hour bloodbath between Bockwinkel and Henning, I didn't realize that Bockwinkel was 50 years old during that time of that match. I was blown away by that, because to me, I mean, he looked older, but I always thought, like, as a kid, oh, he's in his 30s or whatever. But yeah, 50 years old, and he's bumping for Henning like a champ.
And that's the problem, though. As much as he, you know, how good he was as a performer, he was in his 50s, but he was comfort food for Vern. So when he lost all those superstars, he turned back to his comfort food and Bockwinkel, and ultimately he didn't bring up new stars until it was too late. I mean, Kurt Hennig eventually did defeat Nick Bockwinkel, but by that time the AWA was already fading, and he eventually, after his run, would leave to go to the WWE himself. And then, of course, Jerry Lawler, because the influence they had in Memphis, which was still doing okay near the late 80s, seemed to take advantage of it by him going on his extended run as AWA champion, ultimately working out the deal for Super Clash 3 with them and World Class, and then ultimately buying World Class and all that stuff, and how that all went down. Unfortunately, it all went down after that. But again, they just lost all that momentum. They lost all that talent, and they lost. And again, that presentation that they had was just so dated, just a myriad of things. And when you look at it, it did bring us Eric Bischoff. I'm gonna leave it at that.
You know what? With the AWA, just there was so much potential there, I guess is what I was going to say. They had potential to do things. And in fact, you know, one of the other big rumors was always that Jerry Jarrett looked to buy the AWA. So he'd have Minneapolis down through by the Mississippi River. He would have all that territory there. And I just wonder, like, how different would an AWA under the Jarretts look as opposed to the AWA under the Gagnes?
So for John Orlando from the PVD Cast and Matt Talk, it's me, Cheryl Glass. Thanks again for watching this week. Remember, the State of Pro Wrestling, we do regular shows at the end of every month. This is a State of Pro Wrestling special. We'll be back with more opinions, thoughts on the latest news and information on the world of pro wrestling, and also our memories coming up on a special edition down the road as well. So for John Orlando, it's Gerald Glassford. Thanks again for watching, listening. We'll be back soon right here at the State of Pro Wrestling. Ding, ding, ding.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My conversation with Gerald Glassford, talking about the territory system that pro wrestling used to function under. And we took a little walk down memory lane on some of our favorite territories, or you might want to call them promotions, whatever. Originally, we didn't plan on this being so long. We originally had just a few territories to talk about, as we've mentioned before. So you can expect to get another part of the territory story, so to speak, from us in a future episode. But for right now, let me tell you where you can get in touch with me. If you have a question, if you have an opinion you'd like to express about the AWA, ECW, Memphis Wrestling, World Class, whatever, you can do that by reaching out to me. And you can do that a couple different ways. First, you could shoot me an email if you like. JohnOrlando@pvdcast.com is my email address. You can also leave me a message over on the Facebook, Instagram, and Threads account. Those are all under @pvdcast. And I'm still even on Twitter. You can find me over on my personal Twitter handle of @pvdmvp. Now, maybe you want to let some folks know about this show because you really thoroughly enjoyed it. There's a couple different avenues that you can peruse to find the latest episodes of the PVD Cast. The first one being, of course, PVDcast.com, the online home of yours truly. But it's also available through all those major podcasting outlets and apps. All you have to do is go to your favorite outlet or app, put in the search bar PVDcast. Sometimes you have to put my name after it, and you should find it. And while you're using your favorite podcasting outlet or app, please rate and review. It helps me out in the algorithm. And you might as well subscribe so that you never miss an episode of the PVDcast. And there's a third way that you can check out every single episode of the PVDcast, and that is on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I do a little live broadcast of the week's episode. So there's three easy ways to find the show: PVDcast.com, through your favorite podcasting outlet or app, and of course, on Wednesday nights, through the Facebook page at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All right, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here. I want to thank you very much for checking out the episode, and I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, and stay safe and healthy. Presentation of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2026.